The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. If you've been on the internet lately, or read a magazine, or watched TV, or left your house at all, you know that weight loss is big business. The pursuit of the ideal body is centuries old, but entirely subjective. Or is it? What does overweight really mean? Is that a scientific term? And if it is, how important is it to your health? And what exactly can you do about it? Here to give us the skinny on obesity is researcher Peter Januszewski. But before that, we have a couple of announcements. This morning, Grassroots Skeptics rolled out their new Skeptical Speakers Bureau. They've recruited a fantastic lineup of educators, scientists, bloggers, podcasters, and skeptical activists. And they are ready and eager to come speak for your group or event. So if you're a skeptical organizer, there is no excuse not to plan a fascinating presentation for your next meeting. And I'm told that they're still looking for new speakers. So if you've got something to say and you'd like to hook up with organizers in need of speakers, you can sign up for that as well. And you can get more information, check out the roster, and request an appearance by a speaker at grassrootsskeptics.org. Do go take a look. We'd also like to give a shout out to two new stations who have been lovely enough to start rebroadcasting our show. 101.5 UMFM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and CIDO 97.7 in Creston, BC. Welcome, people of Winnipeg, Creston, and surrounding broadcast areas, to 1 hour of science, skepticism, and assorted geekery. We'll do our best to inform and entertain. And to start us off, let's have a bit of speaking up. I'm here today with Carrie Iwin, who wears many hats. Writer, student, skeptic, artist, construction worker, and internet addict. She blogs for skeptchick.org and contributes to the Curiosity Aroused podcast. Welcome to Speaking Up, Carrie.
Hi, Des.
So to give people some background who may not know, what is skeptchick.org?
We are a skeptical website. Rebecca Watson is our boss lady, and we have about 15 different writers, 14 women and one guy, and we range in age from like 22 to almost 50, and just sort of take on various topics in skepticism and women's issues when we find things that are of interest.
So Skepticon is one of the blog's official events.
Yes.
So now this is a skeptical fan track.
Yes, it's basically sort of a very small scale version of what they do at Dragon Con, except it's much more women focused just because Skeptic is in charge of it and I organize it. So I make an effort to make it as heavy with female guests as I can. This year we're looking at about a 4-to-1 ratio of female to male guests.
Nice. So this is at Convergence in Minneapolis.
The Convergence Science Fiction Convention, like I said, it's very small compared to something like Dragon Con, but it's about 2,000 to 4,000 people usually show up, and it's a lot of fun.
So now you say there's quite a few female speakers, which is fantastic. Are there other things that are sort of distinctly female about the event?
We do talk about women in skepticism and you know, try to highlight what we're doing and maybe issues that we might run into that other people might not notice or think are issues.
Give me an example.
Like the whole women at TAM thing, you know, like that sort of became a big thing last year about how, and it sort of becomes a thing every year. Mm-hmm. There's usually like one or two female speakers and the people in charge at the JRF don't really ever think it's that big of a deal, and they think, well, you know, if the women really want to be involved, they'll get involved. But they may not see the barriers that might be there that are preventing women from being more involved. And that's something that we try to dig into and address.
Would you say that you're specifically trying to encourage women to attend the skeptical track?
Absolutely.
But men are allowed?
Oh, sure, yes. Okay. Men are allowed and welcome.
So who would you say is your demographic then?
I suppose you stereotypically would think of like 18 to 24 year old guys, but really we have a last year people showed up at our track ranging from children up to middle-aged people, probably some people even 60s and 70s. We had pretty much run the gamut. It was a very diverse crowd.
So your speakers, there's definitely some diversity there as well. Who's mm-hmm. going to be there?
We have, coming back from last year, some locals, Greg Layden. We're trying to get PZ Myers. We're not 100% if he's going to show up or not, but he said he'd try. We have Debbie Goddard of CFI. We're very excited about her. Jennifer Willett of the Science and Entertainment Exchange. She's awesome, and we can't wait for that. We have, I believe, 5 Skept Chicks. Rebecca is more than likely going to make it. Bug Girl, Maria Walters, myself, Surly Amy. Dr. Pamela Gay will be back again this year. A handful of other local women, Stephanie Zwan and Lois Shadwald. And we're still working on a couple of other people. Oh, yeah, Dr. Jennifer from Chicago will be there also. She's great.
And something you've also done, which is interesting, is turn this into a fundraising event. Or you had a fundraiser for it, right?
Yeah, last year we ended up out of pocket quite a bit on it. We were able to use some Skeptic funding, but right now our Skeptic funding is slightly in limbo because of the fact that Rebecca moved to the UK and took the organization with her.
Right.
So, yeah, we set up a campaign at the point to attempt to raise some money to make sure that we could make it as good or better than last year.
And then there was a bit of a kerfuffle over
yeah, that was unfortunate.
Can you tell the audience about that?
When I was writing the Point campaign, and I was thinking about, okay, I'm trying to pitch this to the skeptic audience who knows who we are. They know we're about, you know, fun and skepticism and a little bit of partying, right? And so I'm just thinking, okay, I'm going to just sort of highlight the fun aspects of this convention. And I included in that our signature drink, the Buzz Aldrin, which is Tang and vodka, which off the record is kind of disgusting, but, you know, we're sort of stuck with it.
Totally fair.
But so I included that in the little Point campaign pitch, not really thinking that, well, you know, maybe that's not exactly the front page thing we should be talking about. And also not realizing that last year, all of our alcohol was actually paid for by tips in the room. So we won't end up having to spend any of our money that we raised from fundraising on the alcohol. So it was just sort of a misstep on my part, and not really thinking that, well, people are going to sit here and analyze what I've written for this fundraising campaign. You know what I mean?
So just to clear it up, the money that you have raised in your fundraising campaign will not go to booze.
No.
Glad to set the record straight. Yes. Are you still doing fundraising?
We're very close to our goal at this point, but we will still be accepting donations. People have been very, very generous, and we appreciate it so much because this money is going to help us to fly in several of our key guests and put them up in the hotel, and also to pay for the room that we have our party in. So that's most of our cost right there. And that money that we raise through the Point campaign will cover, that's 99% of what that will cover.
So besides fundraising, right now you're mainly recruiting people to attend.
Yes, we want people to attend. We are pretty well peopled as far as panelists and guests, but yeah, come and take part, have a good time learning about different aspects of science and skepticism with us, and party with us.
What is the one panel that you're most looking forward to right now?
I'm really excited. We're doing a panel called Losing My Religion, and it's all about, after you've deconverted, how to deal with friends and family that may still be religious. This was actually a suggestion of Jennifer Willett. She had expressed interest in doing something like this, and I totally agreed. As coming from a very religious background, I think it's going to be a really great panel.
So where can people find out more?
There is a tab on Skeptic. If you just look at the top of the page, there's a tab for Skepticon, and all of the relevant information is there.
So when is the registration deadline?
Actually, there is no registration deadline per se. If you show up at the door, you pay $80 and you're in for the weekend. But if you register between now and May 15th, it's only $55. So you have a little bit of incentive to register early. You can register online by going to the Convergence website, which is www.convergencecon.org. And they have a link to a convention reg site that you can use to register online.
And the date of the con itself is?
The con is held July 1 through 4, which will be 4th of July weekend, at the Sheridan South Hotel in Bloomington, Minnesota.
Thanks for being here, Carrie.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking right after this.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, either through the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still hear the broadcast live in our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by clicking on the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to those stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including Citywide LPFM 99.1 in Madison, Wisconsin, CILY Kootenai Cooperative Radio 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia, CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia, CJAI Amherst Island Public Radio 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario, CLHI Rosslyn Radio 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia, CKMS 101.3 FM in Waterloo, Ontario, CIDO 97.7 FM in Creston, British Columbia, Free Thought Radio, and WPRR Public Reality Radio 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I have a quick announcement about Simon Singh's libel case, and I'll give you a bit of background for those of you not following this story on the internet. Mr. Singh, a science writer, wrote an article containing this statement. The British Chiropractic Association claims that their members can help treat children with colic, sleeping and feeding problems, frequent ear infections, asthma, and prolonged crying, even though that there is not a jot of evidence. This organization is the respectable face of the chiropractic profession, and yet it happily promotes bogus treatments. So he was sued by the British Chiropractic Association for libel. Now, this is a problem for all of us for two reasons. There's the whole stifling scientific debate issue, but also one can be sued in English court for statements one makes in other countries if it appears in print in the UK, which is frightening. So during the preliminary hearing, the judge ruled against Singh, saying that he made a statement of fact and not opinion, and so he couldn't use the fair comment defense of his writing. So he appealed, and yesterday he won, which is wonderful-ish, because what he's won is the right to use the fair comment defense in court, which could apparently take another 2 years, not to mention the cost of mounting that legal defense. So this whole case is very complicated, and we can't do it justice today. But please do go to senseaboutscience.org and read about this extremely interesting and potentially groundbreaking case. And today we're on the line with Peter Januszewski. Peter is a PhD candidate at Queen's University studying the effects of exercise and diet on obesity, metabolic risk, and sexual dysfunction. He's published numerous scientific papers and presented at international conferences on topics related to exercise, diet, obesity, body composition, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and more. Peter also blogs at Obesity Panacea. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Peter.
Thanks very much for having me.
So let's start out by defining our terms. Is there an accepted definition of obesity?
Yes, there is. And most people would define that as simply having a body mass index, which is calculated as your weight divided by your height squared. And if that number exceeds 30, Then you were classified as obese in sort of the medical field. That's essentially what defines obesity today. It's simply just that, height over weight.
And so that's standard across different countries and different cultures.
good question. That is a bit of an exception. In most populations, they use the number 30 as sort of the cut point between what would be an overweight versus an obese individual. In some Asian populations, it appears that they seem to develop a lot of the problems of obesity at sort of lower body mass index ranges. So there, some individuals or some societies have developed different cutoff points. Now, there's no sort of gold standard, but I think in Asian populations currently, it's something like 25 or above BMI represents obesity, and I think there's someone else that said 27 or above. So it's a bit of a mixed bag at the moment, but you can be rest assured that everyone over 25 is either overweight or obese, and sort of independent of race and gender.
Okay, there have been some flaws with the BMI, some concerns.
Yep, there's plenty, and they keep coming up in the media.
Do you want to tell us about some of those?
Sure. I guess the one that is most sort of popular, and the one that comes up most often, and I see these sort of blog posts, you know, almost on a weekly basis, someone else is discussing the limitations of the BMI, and the one that's most popular is the fact that body mass index does not differentiate between sort of what I'll call a Michelin man and the Terminator. In a sense, someone could have a BMI of 30 and could either be obese or could be a bodybuilder, right? So many people have heard the notion that, you know, if you, I guess Tom Cruise or Arnold Schwarzenegger, and give me some other buff celebrity name, and that they apparently would be either overweight or obese based on BMI because, you know, they're so muscular and it's the excess muscularity that adds to their weight, not necessarily their excess adipose tissue or fat, which they have very little of. Extremely valid point. Now, the problem with that point is the majority of the population that has a BMI of 25, 26, 32, what have you, does not look like Tom Cruise.
Right.
So for the majority of people who have a body mass index over 25, which would designate overweight, or if they're above 30 to designate obesity, there's probably some need for concern there, I would say. So that's the most popular one, but I would argue that maybe not even the most important. The second problem with BMI is that it doesn't differentiate sort of between the apple shape and the pear shape obese person. And now we've known for over 60 years that regardless of how much you weigh, it is sort of the location of that excess weight that really determines someone's health risk. So we know that if two individuals have a BMI of 32, which so by BMI standards, both are obese, the individual that carries most of their weight in the abdominal region, sort of the apple shape or central obesity, has a much, much greater chance of developing diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and early mortality than does the person who's sort of what has been termed gynoid or lower body or pear-shaped obesity. And, of course, BMI doesn't distinguish between those two. So you could have two individuals, BMI of 32, again, both obese, depending on where that excess weight is carried, they could have varied risk of disease. And maybe the last point, and to me probably the most important one with regards to the limitation of BMI, is that body mass index often does not budge when someone adopts a healthy lifestyle. And that's a problem because many people would then use that sort of as a failure. So if their BMI doesn't change and that tells them whether they're obese or not, then you might, you know, drop those healthy behaviors which you started. And that's unfortunate, because many beneficial things can happen if you start becoming physically active, start eating a healthy diet. Not necessarily that you're cutting a whole lot of calories, but you're just generally adopting healthy behaviors. Your health can change drastically, and yet your body mass index and even the number on your scale might not budge very much. So you can have improvements in aerobic fitness and metabolic risk factors, as well as your waist circumference or your abdominal obesity. So probably the most dangerous place to put that obesity, will reduce even though your BMI might not change. And that, to me, is probably the most important limitation of body mass index.
Interesting. So there's probably a psychological aspect just to not seeing that number change. It could be demoralizing.
Exactly. And part of the problem also is that many individuals have sort of this goal, weight loss goal, and these weight loss goals are, I think, largely driven by what is seen on TV and magazines. You know, Christy Alley loses 300 pounds today, she gains 200 tomorrow. Biggest Loser. I mean, those people are losing tremendous amounts of weight, and people sort of get this very high expectation of what they think is going to happen. And rarely does that happen. I mean, no one can perform the extreme amount of exercise and sort of the extreme dieting that these people do on the show. And so, yeah, a lot of people, I think, see that number not budging very much and say, okay, this is not working, so I'm going to drop it, despite the fact that they are actually getting healthier.
Now, we have an email question on this topic.
I'd been overweight my entire adult life. Last year, however, I lost over 90 pounds after deciding once and for all to change the way I was living and eating. As I dropped the pounds, various people, trying to be supportive and or helpful, I guess, told me I shouldn't lose too much or that I should stop losing, etc. I had a goal weight in mind and ended up surpassing it a bit. But while I used the BMI to figure out approximately where I should be, I arrived at my goal weight fairly randomly. Is there a good way to determine your ideal weight scientifically and with more specificity than the general BMI range? And that question is from David Bloomberg.
Okay, so is there another way to determine ideal weight? I mean, the notion of the amount that one should lose and sort of what effects that has. So if we go back to what I was saying before about sort of general expectations of people, numerous studies suggest that it's somewhere around 30% of their initial body weight is what people are looking to lose. If you look in the medical literature, it suggests that losing 5 to 10% is really something people should aim for, because countless studies show that that range of weight loss is associated with various benefits and metabolic health and, you know, disease prevention, so on and so forth. What happens in reality is that it's closer in the long term, closer to about 2 to 5% with lifestyle intervention and even with pharmacotherapy. Mm-hmm. So with regards to ideal weight loss, I would say probably aim for 5 to 10 if you have to aim for anything. I would suggest, probably more importantly than aiming for any number, is simply aiming for adopting healthy behaviors. So get your, you know, 30 to 60 minutes of moderate intensity physical activity on most days of the week. You know, change your diet, try to follow Canada's food guide as a baseline to sort of measure of what you should be eating. And really look to those things. So, you know, count your steps. And I think that would be probably a lot more important than really just focusing on the weight. Because again, the problem I see with the weight is that it often does not change. And in people who, so this individual says he dropped drastic amounts of weight, which has some potential issues. So there's actually some, we can even talk about some of the issues there of dropping that much weight that quickly. But unfortunately, a lot of people end up regaining a lot of that weight, and some of them even gain more than they started with. And then again, they drop the behavior, and now you're doing yourself more harm.
So does the BMI tell you anything about health at all?
It does. I mean, okay. If you look at sort of population across the population, generally speaking, people with a BMI between 25 to 30 will have a higher risk of, you name an outcome, and they'll have it, whether it's, you know, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, sexual dysfunction, mortality. And then again, at 30, there's also a sort of another increase. So generally speaking, yes, it does tell us in a population sense. Again, on an individual basis, it's much, much less useful. Again, two individuals of the same BMI could have vastly different metabolic health. One could be active and be, the other could be sedentary. One could be pear-shaped, the other could be apple-shaped. One could be genetically predisposed to developing diabetes at a certain body mass index, whereas the other is not. So there's just so many variables at play here that on an individual level, two individuals coming to a physician's office with the same BMI could have vastly different health risks. So, again, useful, but has definite limitations.
Audience, if you have questions about weight and obesity, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. I realized when I started researching the show that I didn't really understand how fat works on a cellular level. Can you explain that?
Sure. And this is sort of a bit of a pet area of mine. It's not necessarily one that I do a whole lot of research in, but it's one that I sort of have developed a lot of interest in over the past little while. So I guess because we're on Skeptically Speaking, we should sort of discuss and debunk some myths. So one major myth that I sort of have come up against is this notion that there's something inherently evil or bad about fat tissue, right? So if you have fat on you, it is, by definition itself, a bad thing. Well, it turns out it's actually quite the opposite. So fat is actually a very necessary organ that actually ensures proper health rather than gives you disease. So we can sort of look at a couple of clinical cases to sort of explain how this whole thing works. So there's this condition called lipodystrophy. Lipodystrophy is sort of a general term which encompasses a whole bunch of disorders, which really are centered around people that have very little or no fat tissue whatsoever. And this can be either a genetic problem or it can be sort of based on a disease state that develops through adulthood. And the interesting thing with these individuals is that the degree to which they're lacking fat tissue is perfectly correlated with the degree of metabolic disturbance that these individuals have. That is, the skinniest of those people, the one with the least amount of fat tissue on their body, is actually the least healthy. At the other extreme, we have something called multiple symmetric lipomatosis. These are individuals who seem to have sort of an indefinite ability just to keep constantly growing fat tissue. More and more fat cells keep growing, growing, growing. They look very much like, I've used this term before, the Michelin man. So very sort of soft looking, lots of rolls. Majority of the fat is stored subcutaneously or sort of underneath the skin. So it's the stuff you can sort of pinch around your midsection and so forth. And these individuals, despite being largely obese, I mean, BMIs into 30s and 40s, these individuals are actually very, very healthy. So the factor here is having enough fat tissue in order to, what many people say is to buffer excess energy. So if you're eating more than you can, than your body needs to survive, that energy, that excess energy that you've consumed must go somewhere. If you have functional fat tissue, you have a whole bunch of adipocytes or little fat cells, those guys are ready to suck up that excess energy. Think of it sort of like a sponge. So you put a whole lot of water on the sponge sucks it up if you have a good sponge, right? So if you have sort of a ShamWow variety, then it would probably work a lot better than sort of the dollar store variety.
Right.
And so that's really what it comes down to, having enough of that sponge to be able to suck up that excess energy. So the people that have no sponge, like the lipodystrophy example I told you before, that excess energy has to go somewhere. And unfortunately, when you don't have fat tissue to suck that excess energy up, it ends up in the liver, the pancreas, the muscle, around the heart. And that's where it really causes all those problems. So merely having excess fat tissue, aside from sort of the problems you might have on joint pain just from carrying an excess load, is not always necessarily associated with greater health risk, because it sort of depends on how you develop that excess adiposity or that excess fat mass. If it happens via sort of a growth of little fat cells, it's a good thing. If you have few fat cells, again, you don't have a sponge or you have a very small or inefficient sponge, then that excess water or that excess energy is going to end up in a lot of different organs, in which it's going to cause a lot of havoc metabolically.
You explained that very well, sir.
Thank you very much.
We have a chat room question.
Is it true that too low a BMI is just as dangerous as a high BMI? And that's from Cat Mac in the chat room.
Too low of a BMI, so underweight. Yes, I mean, this is not necessarily an area that I have a whole lot of expertise in, as most of the people I deal with are 30 BMI and above. But yes, I mean, low weight is associated with health risk. And so what you often see, if you look at sort of a health outcome on a graph, and the BMI from, let's say, 0 to 50, then you sort of see what we often term the Nike swoosh. That is, there is an actual increase right at sort of the lower end of BMI. Then there's the nadir of the curve, sort of the around, you know, 20 to 25, sort of where the lowest risk of a certain outcome is. And then it progressively increases into the high BMI. So, yes, whether it's as high or higher of a risk for diseases, and this would obviously depend on the disease or outcome you're looking at, I'm not entirely sure. But definitely for most outcomes, the lower weight is a health risk, and even more so is a health risk for sort of survival from the disease. So if someone at a BMI of 18 gets some sort of disease, their chance of survival is actually much lower than that of a person who's even overweight, simply because they have sort of less energy to sort of provide the body through fighting with a disease.
All right, we have another website question.
Is there an evolutionary reason that we have this energy storage system? And how does it react to a modern world where food is much more readily available than it was to our primate ancestors?
Right. So, of course, there's genetic susceptibility to obesity, right? And there's also varying degrees to which one person is susceptible to becoming overweight versus another given the same environment. And that really suggests that, evolutionarily speaking, yes, we've sort of adapted these mechanisms which allow us to store a whole lot of energy, because food wasn't always available back in the day, right? I mean, today it's available everywhere. It's plentiful. It's energy dense. It's fairly inexpensive. You don't have to hunt for it. So it's a bit of a maladaptation today, but back in the day, of course, and this is fairly common knowledge, individuals who were sort of more able to store that excess energy during times of, you know, plenty, and then save that energy during times of scarcity of food. So again, when you're, you know, there's periods of feast and famine. So during that famine, if those people that could hold on to that energy, meaning they would not burn a whole lot of calories while they're sitting, they just hold on to that energy you've consumed when last time you ate whatever you ate, they would be more likely to survive during those periods of famine than individuals who, you know, burnt more energy during that same period, or people who were just not as good as at sort of keeping that energy in their body. Now, of course, today those tables have turned entirely, in the sense that the individuals that probably were a lot more likely to survive back then, when food wasn't plentiful, are now, of course, the ones that obviously are at a disadvantage now because food is plentiful. So they're a lot more likely to sort of store all that energy as fat,
right?
Versus individuals who, again, the other direction,
right? Well, in the modern world, we also have things like caffeine and smoking. And how do those affect our metabolism?
Well, with regards to smoking, actually, it's interesting that you bring that up, because a lot of people, when you talk about the obesity epidemic and sort of the potential reasons for why there might be an obesity epidemic, and there's hundreds of papers listing thousands of potential causes, and one of the common ones actually is the reduced number of people that smoke, because smoking has a fairly known effect on satiety. So people that smoke tend to, it sort of suppresses hunger, right? That's what smoking does. So if you have this large trend of people dropping smoking, which we've seen in the past, decade, it would suggest that, you know, there's a lot less people being full, which would suggest that more people are going to eat because they're not smoking. So that's the effect of smoking. Caffeine, on the other hand, is also an appetite suppressant. So having some coffee, I don't know, I'm sure most people have probably noticed this, having a bit of coffee will suppress your hunger. So if it's, you know, it's 11:30, it's right before lunchtime, you have a cup of coffee, you can probably last a little bit longer without sort of those hunger pangs really getting in the way than you would have if you had a glass of water. So they have very, very well-established effects of both caffeine and smoking.
And we have another BMI question from the chat room. I feel like I should have done an entire show on BMI.
This is from Reno Skeptics. Isn't percentage of body fat a better indicator than BMI or weight? One can exercise, build muscle, lose fat, but still be out of the ideal BMI or weight.
Of course, yes. I mean, there's no shortage of methods by which you can sort of measure obesity or really measure the things that are really important. So at the one extreme end, really, sort of the crudest measure we have of obesity is BMI, right? So we sort of talked about limitations of that. You move a little bit upstream of that, an improvement over a body mass index is simply measuring circumferences. So measure the circumference of your abdominal region. You just take a tape measure and you put it around your belly, basically, make sure it's sort of on top of your hip bones. And that number actually tells you quite a bit about your health. And we'd suggest maybe even more so than BMI. There's quite a few papers suggesting that might actually be a more important indicator of health than body mass index. So just for the listeners out there, the number you're looking for, if you're male, it's 102 centimeters. You want to be below that. If you're above 102 centimeters in your waist circumference, it suggests that you are classified as what is called abdominally obese. For females, that number is a little different. It's 88 centimeters. So for women, you want to be below 88 centimeters, and for men, you want to be below 102 centimeters. So that, again, improves sort of our measurement of sort of health risk associated with obesity. If you move further upstream, then I guess the next thing would be you can measure hip circumference, which is another issue, and maybe we don't get into that today. You measure body fat percentage, and that, of course, also is an indicator of health, and I would argue much better one than BMI. But again, total fat percentage also doesn't tell you where that fat is stored, which is another limitation of just getting total amount of fat,
right?
It's sort of the same issue with regards to weight versus where that weight is distributed. So while percentage of body fat is definitely improvement over BMI, I would suggest that something like measuring the amount of fat in the abdominal region might actually be a lot better thing to do. The problem with that, extremely expensive to do. So the only way to measure the abdominal fat and to measure it accurately is through the use of imaging techniques such as MRI or CT. And those things are not sort of done in hospitals on a routine basis. So we can do it for research, but for the average individual, that's not going to happen at the hospital. So again, body fat percentage and improvement, but still doesn't really get at the real issue, which has a lot to do with where that excess fat is stored rather than just how much fat total you have.
This is a far more complicated issue than most people realize. I find this fascinating. We have another chat room question.
All right, this is from Loxloy. And the question is, are sumo wrestlers an example of those that are healthy while having a great deal of fat, or would we consider them high risk?
Excellent question. They are actually fairly low risk while they're competing. This is sort of the interesting thing about sumo wrestlers. They have a tremendous amount of excess body fat, but the distinction there is that they generally store that excess fat, again, underneath the skin. So they're very much like that clinical case of multiple symmetric lipomatosis, or the Michelin man that I talked about before. Along with eating a whole bunch of extra calories, these individuals train a lot. So they're large, and they have a whole lot of fat mass. They also have a lot of muscle mass, which in many sort of disease outcomes is an independent predictor of degree of health, how much muscle mass you have. And the other thing is they have very little abdominal fat, particularly visceral abdominal fat. That's sort of the fat that's stored on the inside of your abdominal cavity. So you sort of think underneath your abdominal musculature. So it's really sort of dispersed amongst your organs. And it's really that fat that seems to be the most critical with regards to health risk. And what sumo wrestlers don't have a whole lot of is that fat depot, that visceral fat. They have very limited amounts of. So despite being very large and having a whole lot of excess adipose tissue, they have very little visceral fat. Part of the reason is because they train so darn hard.
Right.
So we see individuals that there's a little bit of a controversy about this notion, but there's some evidence to suggest that that fat depot, that visceral fat, preferentially is reduced when people become active. So you seem to lose that fat a little quicker than you would fat elsewhere in the body. So this is why the sumo wrestler, despite being very obese, have very limited amounts of visceral fat. And associated with that, they have fairly good metabolic health. What happens with these individuals, once they stop training, then everything goes out the window. They very quickly accumulate that visceral fat, and their metabolic profile goes downhill. So it's only during their active phase, when they're, you know, constantly participating or training, that you would say that they would be sort of the healthy obese. As soon as they stop the activity, things start to slide in the wrong direction.
Okay, so for everybody but sumo wrestlers, then, what kind of health effects do we know for sure are associated with obesity?
Good question. For sure. correlations have been drawn between basically excess weight and everything under the sun.
Mm-hmm.
What we know for sure, that is a very interesting question because, again, it depends on how you define obesity, right?
Right.
So if you're really just looking at body mass index or you're just looking at percent body fat, the links between those things and a certain disease outcome are a little hazy, to be honest. When you look at the amount of, for example, visceral fat, again, which is sort of a topic of interest in our laboratory, the links there are, again, most of it is fairly correlative. So we don't have causation is a bit mysterious in this area because we don't have a whole lot of research telling us exactly how one thing leads to another. And there's no shortage of theories by which that's possible. But the short answer is we're not really sure how excess fat or excess visceral fat or what have you really leads to diabetes, cardiovascular disease, what have you. Again, multiple proposed mechanisms, but when it really comes down to it, we don't really have a clear case of, look, this happens, and then that follows immediately. All we have is a lot of studies showing correlation between having more fat and having greater risk of disease.
How about mortality? I seem to remember reading a study a while ago saying that there was a higher mortality rate for people that were overweight.
Mortality is one of those ones that's been a little tricky, because in certain age groups, it looks like, so for example, in the elderly, it looks like mortality rates are actually not that much higher in those who actually carry a bit of excess weight, and somewhat, again, this is based on body mass index. And so some studies have suggested that people who are 60 and above, who actually have a BMI sort of in the, you know, above 25 or above 30, might actually be at a lower risk of death than people in the lower BMI range. Why that's the reason, maybe it's BMI in that age group becomes more of a marker of muscle mass, which again, like I said before, is sort of an indicator of, well, and the elderly, especially of sort of functional capacity and, you know, the ability to move around and that sort of thing. And it also suggests that during times of, you know, if someone gets various diseases, the individual that has a lot of excess energy in their body to draw upon during those disease states may have a greater chance of survival than someone who doesn't have a lot of excess energy to start with. So BMI and mortality is one of those ones that's been a little bit tricky. And every once in a while a study comes out and, you know, the media goes crazy because, hey, look, the obese are dying a lot less frequently than the lean. It's a bit of a blurry issue. But one thing that seems to be coming out of that literature is the fact that BMI, a higher BMI might be slightly sort of protective in sort of older individuals. So the issue of whether, you know, an older individual should lose weight is one that's been a bit blurry, really.
So there seems to be a lot of correlation versus causation and such. So do you think we as a people are focusing too much on the weight aspect of this?
I wholeheartedly believe that's the case, yeah. This is not to suggest that there isn't an association, that there isn't, you know, a direct link between excess fat mass and disease risk that we simply have not really done a great job of figuring out. It's simply that I think it distracts. More than anything else, the focus on having too much weight or too much fat mass distracts from I think, the more important message, which really is, like I said before, the healthy behavior. So adopting a physically active lifestyle and eating, a balanced diet, I think, goes a long way, independent of any effects of weight or fat mass or what have you. And that probably more than anything else is what irks me personally, that there's such an overriding focus on how much someone weighs and, you know, checking in the scale every single day and that kind of thing, that I think a lot of people sort of lose track of what's really important, because the weight change or lack thereof often masks much benefit that's happening to your health when you're, again, becoming active and eating healthy.
Audience, Peter is available to answer any and all questions on weight and obesity. Email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio, and we'll be right back after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're joined by journalist and best-selling author David Schenck to discuss his new book, The Genius in All of Us, Why Everything You've Been Told About Genetics, Talent, and IQ is Wrong. We'll dig into the relationship between intelligence, talent, and genetics. When it comes to the brain, does DNA always equal destiny, or can hard work mean more than heredity? And on Speaking Up, Skeptic North Editor-in-Chief Steve Toms gives us the facts about Homeopathy Awareness Week. IQ, Genes, and You, next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and we're here with Peter Januszewski, obesity researcher. So, Peter, what about the concept of dieting, going on a diet? Is that ever a good idea?
Here again, I have some issues with that, because the concept of exactly how you put it was perfect. Going on a diet suggests that it's something that you do for a little bit of time, and then you get off of it and go back to your unhealthy habits. And that's really not the way to go about these things. So slowly making changes in the way you eat, the things you eat, sort of the frequency with which you eat, those are things that you should change and maintain throughout your lifestyle. Going on a grapefruit diet or, you know, eating seeds only or whatever crazy thing that comes out isn't really the way to go about getting becoming healthier. Yes, you will lose weight. And really, there's been now a few studies coming out suggesting that, you know, this whole debate of Atkins versus, you know, the South Beach or whatever diet,
right.
it really doesn't matter. If you consume less calories, you're gonna drop some weight. The problem is that it's very hard to maintain that. To be sort of in a caloric deficit where you're constantly eating less than you require, is tough to maintain. A lot of people seem to, you know, about the 6 month mark or 3 to 6 month mark actually, tend to start to slide back to their old habits. So, the idea of going on a diet and then going back to your, you know, regular routine once you've, you know, lost 15 pounds or, actually, this is them. When I watched that show, like the last 10 pounds, I don't know if you've seen this on like TLC or something. Oh God, it drives me absolutely bananas. So again, and you have this idea of, oh, I need to lose 10 pounds. I'm going to go on a diet, right? So again, I'll eat grapefruits for 2 weeks and sure enough, you'll lose 10 pounds. But guess what? Once that's over, what are you going to do now? You can't eat grapefruits for the rest of your life. So the idea of going on a diet is one that again bothers me. So I think the focus should really be on making small changes in the way you eat. So moving away from, you know, snacking a lot of salty carbohydrate, fat laden foods, eating sort of frequent meals throughout the day, smaller meals, increasing the amount of protein in those meals. You know, simple things, even as making your plate smaller, which would give you, there's been some interesting studies on sort of the effect of having a large versus small plate with the same volume of food, what effect that has on you psychologically with how full you might feel after that meal. And really the idea of never letting yourself get hungry is probably a lot more important than necessarily going on a diet.
Now, you mentioned the Atkins diet. That's a high protein diet. Does that cause any health problems? It seems like it would.
Yes, there was some literature. Now, I am not 100% sure of this, to be completely honest with you. There was some literature suggesting some health effects of an Atkins diet, but I am actually right now drawing complete blank, so I'd rather not speculate rather than.
You are a good skeptic, sir.
Yeah, okay.
Try. Evidence-based.
That's right.
We have another chat room question.
I want to know if it's true that yo-yo dieting ruins your metabolism. I was told that I will never have a normal metabolism because I've dieted too much in my life. And that's from Julie in the chat room.
Interesting question. There's definitely been no shortage of evidence suggesting that yo-yo dieting, which I guess that we should define for those who are not aware of what this means, so I've talked before about the notion that oftentimes people who lose weight quickly in the short term, which again, most people can do fairly easily with basically any method you adopt. Within 3 months, you can probably shed quite a bit of weight. What happens is in the long term, you start to drift back to your starting weight and then people go above that weight. And so you sort of have this constant up and down of people who are going on repeated diets. The evidence suggests that individuals who actually, so let's say there's two individuals with a BMI of 32, one of them maintains that 32, so it doesn't really change anything, just stays exactly where they are, and the other person goes from a 32 to a 30, back to a 32, back to a 30, back to a 32, up and down, over the same time course, the individual who has maintained their weight, really hasn't done anything to change their lifestyle, seems to be actually doing better with regards to sort of risk of disease or early mortality than the individual who's been dropping and increasing their weight. The reasons for that are not entirely clear. And so this question of does it mess up your metabolism to the point where it cannot be further repaired, I've never actually heard that notion. That's not to say, once again, that it's simply something I haven't read about because it's slightly outside my area of research. But I would caution that it's probably not that big of an issue. So yes, yo-yo dieting can again have impacts on various health outcomes, but really how that happens or whether it's a permanent sort of detriment to your health, I'm not entirely sure, especially with regards to metabolism.
And another question from the chat room.
How about the various wild, unsubstantiated claims of supplements sold to dieters and how they get adulterated with drugs? And that's from Eosign in the chat room.
Okay, so that's an issue that we've tried to tackle. That's one of the primary reasons we actually started the blog Obesity Panacea. It's because, you know, despite sort of being in this area of research and, you know, trying to teach all our friends and our family about it, as I've already told Des, that I found a bottle of hydroxycut in my parents' cupboard, which just drove me up the wall. And then lo and behold, 3 months after that, you know, hydroxycut's pulled off of shelves because it's associated with liver toxicity, and there's been a number of instances of mortality tied to the use of hydroxycut. So yes, there is no shortage of gimmick products that are on the shelves of most drugstores in Canada and the U.S. I'm assuming it's the same case. There's now, if you go to Shoppers Drug Mart, there's an entire aisle of these things, and it's growing. Every time I get there, there's more and more products. And so initially, we actually tried to go product by product and try to debunk each individual one, but it is absolutely impossible to keep up with the number of products that, again, on a weekly basis sort of appear on these shelves. Every single one of those products is useless. At best, it's useless. Mm-hmm. At worst, it could cause harm. The problem with the way things are set up right now is that a product does not necessarily need to show that it is effective to be placed on a shelf in a drugstore. It simply needs to suggest that right now, as far as we know, it's not going to cause any harm. And that's required. And again, legislation of this stuff is, again, slightly beyond my understanding, but that's from my basic understanding, this is basically where we stand right now. So a product is put on a shelf, and basically you, the public, is the study. You're testing whether this is actually going to cause problems.
Oh, good.
So this is why 3 years down the line, you have cases of, again, like so with the hydroxycut thing, you have cases where people are having liver problems and some of them are dying potentially because of hydroxycut use, and then that product is pulled off a shelf. So that's sort of the problem. And a lot of these products are you know, the ingredients on the back suggest that it's, you know, there's some crazy extract of some weird fruit found in some jungle in Brazil, mixed with some sort of tea thing, mixed with some sort of seed, whatever. Oftentimes it really comes down to how much caffeine the product has. That's really right. All it is. And unfortunately, many of these products it's been found that many of these products actually include things that really should not be in there. So some of them have, these are just stories that I've heard of sort of prescription medications actually being placed into these concoctions. So I would say really save your money. The stuff that's on those shelves is largely ineffective. We do not have a cure for obesity. There is no such thing right now. So no matter what the commercials tell you, no matter what the countless products claim to do, they are ineffective and potentially harmful. So I would save yourself some money and stay far, far away from that aisle at the drugstore.
Well, some people are absolutely desperate to lose weight for whatever reason, and we actually have a website question about that.
Do many really have a chance, considering the new study shows compulsive eating shares an addictive biochemical mechanism with cocaine and heroin abuse? That is from Gary in Medicine Hat.
Right. That is a quite an interesting study that just came out recently. Basically suggesting that there's sort of an addictive nature to people who overeat, especially sort of these high-fat, high-carbohydrate foods. And this goes back to sort of the pleasure-seeking aspect of excess eating. So it's a lot of people suggest, and there's sometimes comments in our blog to the effect of, why can't people just understand, just eat less and move more? It's so simple. Well, yes, it is. It really is just about calories, but when it comes down to real life, it's a lot more complicated than that. Our bodies are built very, very interestingly and a lot of the times simply saying cut calories and move more is not really effective enough because of things like this. So, you know, excess or sort of excess eating is sort of like an addiction to a drug. So, it gives you pleasure. It's not necessarily that you're hungry and you're eating. It's that you're requiring this, you know, you want the feel-good hormones to be circulating in your brain. So you then go for the chocolate or you go for the chips because those things bring you the sensation of pleasure. It's not that you're hungry. It's just that you want a little bit of a high, so to speak. And so this evidence suggests that with time, much like sort of you get desensitized, so cocaine users or whatever sort of get desensitized to the drug and have to keep upping the dosage of the drug, it's sort of similar in food, such that, you know, we need to keep upping the dosage of food, so you keep eating more and more and more to satisfy that sort of drive for pleasure, which obviously complicates things. Now, does that mean that, you know, everyone has lost the war Not necessarily. And again, it goes back to my original point, which really is that focusing on the weight is really, really myopic, and I think it really just distracts from the issues. A lot of people will use this sort of evidence as sort of an excuse to not make these changes in their lifestyle, saying, well, look, I might as well be addicted to cocaine. Look at this, I can't fight this. That's fine. That is a very legitimate point. The problem is it does not excuse you from not adopting a healthy lifestyle and not trying to eat a little healthier. Those things can happen. Again, weight will not budge, but you will get healthier. And so I think it's really important to keep those sort of messages. And every once in a while, the media sort of blows these things out of proportion and says, oh, look, we've all lost. There's no point in doing any of this because, look, it's not going to lead to weight loss. That's fine, even if it didn't. Let's not stop there. Let's focus on things that, to me, are maybe more important, because you're going to live longer, a healthier life, if you simply become more active and eat a healthier diet.
We have another chat room question. I love how active the chat room is tonight.
How much of the increase in obesity do you attribute to advertising, wherein the visual cues of thin people eating huge portions of fattening stuff are used to transmit the message that everyone can consume the advertiser's product all the time with no negative effects?
Right. And this goes back to sort of one of the original points we discussed, which is what's the cause of the obesity epidemic, right? Why are we all getting bigger? How much can I attribute the obesity epidemic to advertising? I have absolutely no idea, and I'm not sure that anyone does. Surely there's been studies suggesting that. I think there's actually one in children that came out not that long ago that suggests that sort of exposing children to food commercials seems to sort of increase their drive to eat, which makes perfect sense. That's why, you know, Cheerios are marketed to children, because the more you market it, the more parents will buy it because the kids want to eat it. So it makes perfect sense. Advertising will likely lead to an increased ingestion of that food. How much that's responsible for the increase in the obesity epidemic, aside from a multitude of other factors, I have absolutely no idea. I would argue that it definitely plays a role. How big of a role? I'm not entirely sure.
Now, that is very closely related to something that you just wrote on your blog, titled, Is Jesus Making You Overeat? Now, we have very little time to talk about this, but if you could just give us just a couple of sentences about what that was about.
Okay, so a recent study came out basically looking at the depiction of the Last Supper, right? So everyone's seen that. It's Jesus and his apostles having that meal there. And we're looking over the last 1,000 years, and basically these researchers were interested to see how the sizes of the food, or how the proportion of food has changed throughout time as they were depicted in these paintings. And what we see is over the 1,000 years that this painting has been drawn and redrawn and redrawn, is that there's a large increase in, one, the size of the plates, and two, the amount of food that's presented. So sort of, again, going along with the notion that portion sizes in our society are constantly increasing. So they're trying to draw a parallel between, hey, look, portion sizes are increasing, and it's even impacting the way we draw things. It's impacting art.
And that was succinct, sir, and a very good place to leave things. Peter, thanks very much for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
And you can visit Peter at scienceblogs.com/obesitypanacea. And he's also quite active on Twitter at PM Januszewski. And if you can't spell that off the top of your head, there's a link to both the blog and the Twitter feed on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. There's also links to our Twitter feed, our Facebook group, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.